Hi there, Ants Cabral here. Thanks for tuning into this episode. Before we jump into the conversation, I wanted to let you know about the Doing Better Work Together online gathering coming up. From November the 29th to December the 2nd, we'll be hosting 4 days of talks, workshops, connection and collaboration sessions running across all time zones. It'll be a great chance to learn from and connect with practitioners and innovators working across decentralized organizing, new ways of working, community building, decision making, personal development, remote teamwork, and much, much more. Tickets are on sale at doing.betterworktogether.co, and you'll find more information in the show notes. With that, on with the episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the very first episode of the Better Work Together podcast. I'm Ants Cabral, and I'm hosting these conversations with people who are building tools, developing methods, and sharing stories from the frontiers of collaboration and organization building. I'm really stoked today to be joined with two of my longtime friends, Alana Irving and Francesca Pick, who have both been doing amazing work in this space for quite a few years in lots and lots of different ways. Before we kick into the conversation today, which is focused around groups spending money together and different processes in which that happens, I'm going to throw to them both to introduce themselves and give us a little bit of context and background on their work. I know it's hard to sum it up in just a few sentences, but we'll give that a go. Fran, I might throw it over to you first, if that's okay.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here, Ants, and to talk about this subject. So yeah, I've been working in the space of, I guess, collaborative organizing since about 2012. And that's actually when I joined a network called WeShare that is a global network where I was able to, I guess, do a very hands-on practice-based experimentation for many years on how to actually develop collective governance practices, make decisions with people in many different countries, and sort of manage a decentralized network. And over the years, I guess I've always been very interested in the question of how different software tools can enable groups to sort of keep improving and getting better at how they can govern collectively and share leadership. And that's actually how I then met Inspiral and you and Alana, another one of these networks. And so from that path of many years of working in these different networks, that's really the focus of what I'm doing now with a collective that I started a few years ago called Greater Than, where we're helping various networks, different types of groups and organizations with questions like how to spend money together as groups and how to actually do self-organizing well in a way that works and helps us thrive and achieve our objectives and missions. So yeah, I think that's maybe like a little recap. And maybe the only other thing to mention is that I work a lot around a tool called CoBudget. And that's one of the things we've been doing in Greater Than to help groups spend money together.
Well, I'll jump in. Hello, I'm Alana. My mom likes to tell this story about me from when I was about 4 years old, about the kids on the playground not being able to agree on a game to play and me trying to organize a democratic vote and like trying to explain how this process is supposed to work and all the kids just crying and it not working at all. But basically, like, yeah, I've just been like that since the beginning. So I guess sort of naturally drawn to looking at a group and asking, you know, how can it function well together? How can we coordinate? Partially just from my own sense of impatience of like, this could be more optimal. Let's get ourselves organized. And partially, I guess, from an inner desire to not allow my leadership tendencies to end up being like control freak tendencies or trying to like boss people around or something and trying to like channel those in a more constructive or values aligned direction. So very interested in this weird word called leadership and what it means when it's not about coercive power hierarchies and just how I can, as somebody who just sort of naturally goes towards like the kind of maybe coordination managery layer of group dynamics, like where does that go in a way that's consent based and constructive. So yeah, got involved in a lot of different environments where I sort of learned by trial and error, lots of different concepts and practices around this stuff, whether you call it coordination or facilitation or process design. I moved to New Zealand in 2011 and got involved with the Inspiral Network in the very, very early days when it was coming together here in Wellington. As Fran mentioned about We Share, Inspiral is also just like a very rich experimental ground where we were trying things and like looking back on it now, realizing that we were trying some like very intense, like we were doing a really intense version of a lot of things and learning at an incredible rate and asking a lot from ourselves and each other. And that was just like amazing. So we ended up doing a lot of experiments in how can large groups of people come together and make decisions and communicate and deal with things like money in a way that is collaborative and transparent and participatory. So I'm really interested in those ideas. And I just kind of got, very interested in leadership as a concept and then also money as a lens on all of these questions, and just kind of got really interested in it because it's so tangible, it's so quantifiable, it's so powerful. Like people immediately get kind of their interest gets activated when you say, hey, you've got control of some money, or it represents, I think, so much in people's minds. I got really interested in the role of money and all of that, and co-created this thing called Co-Budget that Fran mentioned, which we prototyped at Inspiral, which was about participatory budgeting, as well as decision-making tools and processes and all this kind of thing. And then about 6 years ago, got involved in Open Collective, which is a tool for transparent and collaborative fundraising and money management. But I kind of see it as a little bit of a Trojan horse. Really what it's about is collaborative governance and kind of these deeper questions about what commoning, owning things, owning resources together, and really just reframing so many of the ways that our society out there deals with resource allocation and everything. Like what if we just reclaimed all of that and thought deeply about doing it in community-focused ways of sharing, really. So I've been working on that for about 6 years now, and have been lucky enough to do lots and lots and lots of different kinds of experiments with money, collaborating with money, basically.
Amazing. Yeah. And so, I mean, just from that intro, it's such a broad, entangled space whenever we bring this money thing into organizations. Perhaps a good place to start this conversation, and I know we're going to get into governance and power and decision making and all of that good stuff, no doubt. But you've both mentioned this tool, Co-Budget, and it is a common thread for the three of us. And I wonder if maybe we can start there and talk about collaborative budgeting. Fran, I know this has been top of mind for you with the Co-Budget work lately, and I'm wondering if you can just share your definition or just a framing around how you're thinking about collaborative budgeting now and how Co-Budget fits into that.
Yeah, so I guess budgeting is a funny word that I gotta say I'm not a big fan of. And it's interesting because there are always, as it is with this kind of jargon, that there's like many different variations, collaborative budgeting, participatory budgeting, which is used a lot in the civic context. And I guess for me, the word budgeting, it generally indicates that you're planning, right? So you're planning an allocation of money over a certain period of time. And the idea of doing that collaboratively is that a group is involved in the planning. And what I always found really interesting in the co-budget context, which maybe also Alana can say more about, like where this actually came from, was that we were always talking about collaborative funding, which is really more the notion of we're actually spending the money together rather than we're planning on what we might do with it. And I guess what I find really interesting is actually to sort of question what budgeting actually needs to be for the way of organizing that we want to do. And that looking at a lot of different self-managed organizations out there, also sometimes called teal organizations, there's a lot of interesting practices around much more dynamic, responsive ways of spending money that are less about creating a big budget once a year that then, you know, maybe happens or actually in the end turns out completely differently. So for me, the idea of the co-budget sort of encapsulates and what we've been practicing in a lot of the networks that we're in is, I think, trying to sort of make budgeting in its current form a bit obsolete and shifting it to more of a continuous collective process of assessing what resources do we have, what are the problems we need to solve, what do we want to make happen, and then how do we put the money there to make those things happen.
So if in a traditional organization, if it's a few people that have view of how much money there is and what the goals of the organization are, and they plan and allocate to hit those goals in whatever way they want, and then things get executed. If we flip that upside down into more of what you're talking about, what does that look like practically? So could you just share a little bit about, like, I know did a lot of iteration at Inspiral, and so.
I mean, I think there's many different ways that this can be done. And so the basic idea is that rather than there being very few people that have an overview of the finances and decide on the allocation, that that's a much larger group. And that can go from, you know, I mean, that could be a very, very large group, like many people in the crypto space are experimenting with, to being like a sort of, a network of subgroups that are participating. And I guess the transparency of the money is a key piece there. So we're really talking about those two elements of everyone being able to see, like, what is the money that's there? How is it being allocated by whom? And giving more people a voice in that allocation. And then if you look around, you know, there's many different examples. There's some groups that literally just do like a consent or a consensus process around how to allocate money. Then maybe there's others that are doing a vote. So if you look at a lot of cities that do participatory budgeting, usually you have a platform where people propose different projects and then you can vote like yes or no on a project. That's sort of a different model than what CoBudget does, which is more basically voting with money. So if I have, let's say, a budget of $10,000, and I have a group of 10 people, just to make it really easy, that wants to collaboratively budget. The way we do it in CoBudget is that if I could decide to say each person has an equal vote in what happens with those 10,000. So each person will have $1,000 to vote with their money. And so they just allocate the money to the projects that they think we should do. So I would say, you know, when it comes to governance and like these sort of voting decision-making mechanisms, there's so many different things that you can try out and really many interesting innovations also coming up in the crypto space right now. But the basic idea really is more people are participating in that decision and that it's transparent. I hope that makes it a bit more clear.
Totally, totally. And so I want to take the story right back to the very beginning. Alana, could you talk a little bit about how the early days of CoBudget emerged in Spiral?
It was a very practical intervention at the beginning. We were basically a freelancer collective at that stage, and we worked on a model of all the different workers would be doing contracts for clients or different pools of income, and a percentage of their income would go into our shared money pool, and we would then make decisions collectively about what to do with that shared pool. And as we scaled from, you know, a dozen people to, you know, two dozen to 40 to 50, it just, you know, it's really unwieldy to have those conversations if you don't have good tooling. On a really practical level, it was like I was doing the kind of back office admin, and it was like me and one or two other people who actually just had the login to the bank account or could even really see what was going on or move money around. And that just didn't feel right. Like, we were really aspiring to be a true collaborative network. But at the same time, it was a network of very busy people who had a lot going on and were not going to spend, you know, endless hours in a conference room, you know, working this all through. Like, in previous to that, I had experiences living in housing cooperatives and stuff where the vibe was really like, we're going to have a 6-hour meeting and talk through this whole thing. And it, you know, that has its merits, but in the environment where it was much more like a fast-paced kind of startup-y freelancer collective, that was not the vibe. So we just had to think of a way to do this that was engaging and that was practical and that would help make better decisions about our money. And I guess it was, to me, it's all symbolic of like what's important to us. What are we trying to achieve? What's our strategy? What are our values? Like, money is just a really tangible way to start measuring some of those things or surface those conversations. So it started just as a spreadsheet. It was literally just like, okay, what people, these are the different amounts that people gave this month to the common pool, and they can retain allocation rights over those amounts. And we're going to have a spreadsheet. And if you want to do a project or get paid money into your budget to do more with our collective funds, you put your project down as here down the side of the spreadsheet, and we'll put the money across the top, and then everyone could just go in there and allocate their funds. And that's just where it started. And I think it really uncovered some very interesting dynamics, specifically that dynamic of I'm giving part of my money to a shared pool, but I'm retaining some control over it or influence. I'm retaining proportional influence of what happens in that shared pool was a very powerful mechanic, because it caused people to feel like very tangibly motivated to like, oh, I'm going to participate in these conversations about what we're doing with our shared money. And I'm going to be, this matters. This is very directly related to me. It's not this far off abstract thing that it's not related to my day-to-day work. And then also the experience people would have of having an idea, putting up a, we call them buckets for funding, putting up a bucket and then getting it funded and getting that mandate from the rest of the network. Like, yes, we support this. And yes, you can have this money and go hire people or go, you know, buy the things, do what you need to do. I think that was a really powerful dynamic. And then also, I guess, brings in questions about like accountability, like, oh, well, how do we follow up on these things? And it just creates a really tangible frame for those conversations. So it started as a spreadsheet. And then just as we were scaling more, and because we were a, you know, software freelancer cooperative, of course, building software became a question. And it started out as just this little in-house project. But once we built it, it was clear that it could be really useful to other people. And at that time, that was a really common kind of pattern that was emerging at Inspiral, was like have an internal kind of experimental need come up with a very MVP, you know, ugly, packed together process of doing it, test some things out, iterate, and then turn it into software which could be shared to others, and that could be useful to others who want to work in this way. And, you know, similar thing happened with Lumio and other tools that we worked on at Inspiral. So that's kind of the origin of it. And then it turned into this, it's just an open source software project. And I think it's really interesting how CowBudget, it was never a company really, like nobody really made it with a sense of like, oh, this is going to be a startup called CowBudget. It was more like a function out in the world that filled this niche and people wanted it to exist. So I was really, really thrilled when, after kind of a few different stages of development, ended up with Fran holding it and working on it and taking it into its next stage. And yeah, I don't know. It just felt like I was just very happy to see it out in the world, because I know I've talked to many groups who've used it. I still use it in my day-to-day work at the company that I work in now. We use it. It's super useful. So I think that's just the feeling of like hitting on a, I guess as a facilitator, that's exciting for me. Like, oh, it came up with a process that has these interesting dynamics and other people want to do it. That was cool.
I think that's a really nice framing there around actually, so often we think about a software product as it needs to be a company. But actually in this case, the piece of software is just a codified tool that embodies a lot of processes. And it sits in the world, and it's stewarded by a company, but it's not a company on its own right. And I think to me, that feels like quite a unique way of thinking about these kind of things as different functions for groups. I know, like, as we go through all of these different examples of different ways that people have come to me many times and said, oh, I'd love to be in a highly collaborative group. Wouldn't it be awesome if we could share all of our value? We could like really do all of these things together deeply. And then money comes into the conversation, and all of a sudden it all feels different. It feels harder. And I know we used to have this saying, right, that like money makes collaboration real. And everyone loves this idea of collaboration. And that means sharing money, and it means sharing control. I'm curious, like on your both journeys, like what are the obvious hard things that have emerged in groups when these kind of things come up? You've both talked about decision-making and power and that kind of stuff, but is there anything that feels like a really strong, difficult pattern that makes it hard?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's quite a few consistent challenges that are also really fascinating. And I guess one of them is related to people's relationship to money. Like personally, because I guess often when coming into a group and saying, okay, let's talk about money heads on, let's do a collaborative budgeting process, let's set this up. Sometimes with a certain proportion of that group, you sort of meet like a dead silence. And I really describe it as like a dead silence, because it's like, there's just somehow nothing, like nothing coming back. And I think what often we do see happen is that like money can really create a very strong impact on people, and trying to talk about it can really like, it can be emotional. It can bring up things. And so that is like a lot of energy to hold that might show up if you're bringing this topic to the table and wanting to create a process. And that sometimes a very simple question like, oh, why aren't you asking for money? Like, why aren't you putting up your project? And why aren't you adding the budget? Like, oh, how much do you need for this? Sometimes it's just there's so many things in the way of being able to articulate that. Maybe because, you know, we're not familiar with even how to scope a budget or how much we need. Maybe because we don't feel like we're deserving, that we even have the right to ask for something because that's very hard. Like all these things that are really understandable. But yeah, I think that that's almost like one of the first barriers, that like it can just be quite scary to break through that and do these sometimes what seems very simple things of pitching your project, saying how much money you need to actually do it. I guess, so in connection with that, like low engagement, I think is sort of a very common challenge, that it's hard to get people maybe either to participate in the allocation part, so voting on the projects, as well as people proposing projects. So it's a bit like a marketplace problem, that sometimes you have lots of money and people that want to decide, but you don't have great ideas, or sometimes it's the other way around. And so that imbalance is something that one often has to navigate. And from my experience, often the reason that's happening is that maybe it's not actually clear, like, what is the purpose of this group wanting to spend money together? Like, what are we trying to do? What is our objective? And therefore, what are actually the types of things we might want to fund to make that real? So I think, yeah, like just sort of saying, oh, great, we're a group. So of course, if we have money, we're going to do great things. Like that's not enough. You need a reason to actually be there and something that you want to achieve. So yeah, maybe before I add more, I want to make some space for Alana to jump in, because I could probably keep going here.
I want to hear all your stories from all the groups you've worked with, co-budget with and everything. So let's get to that. But yeah, I mean, I feel like there's some really obvious ones that come up a lot. Like anytime a group has not dealt with its issues around power, or you've got people holding on to all the power, not wanting to share it and not wanting to truly, like, money is a little bit of like a heuristic for control and power. And if you're not worked through those issues, then they're all going to get surfaced if you try to do kind of collaborative budgeting or whatever. But I'm kind of like, I don't want to say those problems are boring, but it's like, I'm past it. Like I work with groups that are committed to the like shared power thing and truly want to do transparency and true collaboration. And it's honestly, it's still challenging, even if you overcome all of those challenges. So some counterintuitive challenges I think you face even past all that stuff. Like a lot of times I'll see groups, because, well, I work at Open Collective, which is a fundraising tool. So I get to see just literally thousands of groups and how they raise money and what they do with it. And we notice this interesting trend where some groups would just kind of be building up money and just not spending it. And this actually happened a lot with co-budget as well, that people would be building up their co-budget dollars and not allocating them or something like that. And there are different things that can be uncovered once you dig into that. Sometimes it's like, oh, I'm saving up because I want to do something, you know, big with this money, or we're waiting for this milestone or something like that. But a lot of times it's just that the person individually or the group together has not done all of the deep thinking about, you know, what Fred mentioned about what are we here to do with this money? What's our strategy? What's important to us? Or perhaps the work to collectively feel that mandate to actually do things in the world with money, take risks. Spending money is risky. It feels like losing something maybe, or you have to be, yeah, you could always potentially fail, or you can spend money and it not work out. And then you feel this sense of loss. But then there's also just like a huge amount of context building and capacity building that's required to successfully have, I would say, like proper conversations about money. Like, I think one of the reasons why more traditional organizations tend to do budgeting with a small group behind closed doors is just it feels infeasible to get everybody up to speed on all of that context. And you have to do a real deep dive and have skills there, like how do you facilitate a whole group to get on the same page about strategy and then be able to successfully make smart decisions about how to allocate their money? That's a whole area of questions. So I'm thinking about that a lot recently, because Open Collective is heading towards this exit to community idea, where we're going to try to basically transition ownership of the platform to the whole community and co-govern it. But I'm not, I'm not naive about it. It's going to take a lot of capacity building and a lot of relationship building and everything. But do you imagine that entire network trying to decide, okay, we have this income from the platform. Now, what are we going to do with it? Which features do we want to build? You know, everything that would come with that kind of co-governance. And I think it's just a massive investment in facilitation and relationship building and information sharing and all of these communication systems and tooling and everything. And a lot of people don't necessarily know how to do that, or they don't. Sometimes people misunderstand that investment as well. They think like, oh, that's a massive, like we don't have time or we don't have capacity for all of that. But it's like, okay, but yeah, you have to invest a bit upfront to set it all up. But I think in the long term, that can actually be more efficient. Like the individual decisions might take longer or be more complex. But once you've reached those decisions, once the budget is there, you've got everybody on the same page, everybody deeply understanding the strategy of why you made the choices that you did. Everybody's, you know, buy-in of like, yeah, co-ownership, and just like nobody, well, maybe not nobody, but most people not dragging their feet or working at cross purposes. And just imagine the efficiency of such a group if you have invested in getting there.
I think you've both articulated something in different ways that I think is really important here. And that's like when this happened for us at Inspiral, and it wasn't planned, but when we did all that stuff, when we shared money and figured out how to do it and use co-budget and did all these things that appear really logical and straightforward, a bunch of things happened around learning new capacities and learning new skills and sharpening up the collective strategy of what the hell we were doing in the first place. So I can imagine if you're building an organization, or you're trying to build an organization or grow an organization, using money as a lever in order to upskill everybody in the organization and to get that really, really precious alignment and engagement around a strategy and improve a strategy, I could see that as being extremely valuable and not really like, not really a cost, really just a really good business case for doing that. You mentioned like the investment that has to happen in order to get there. That definitely feels real. I'm curious if there's any practical, really good examples that you've seen, especially Fran, I know that you've been stewarding co-budget lately. Are there any examples that you would want to point to of groups just doing this really well and what that looks like?
Yeah, so I guess I get quite a diversity of different types of examples out there. And I think we learn different things from different like setups around this. And so one of them that I'm really excited about that's quite new is actually where I would probably describe the process more as collaborative or participatory grant making in a way, which is something that people are also using co-budget for. And this is actually a case where there's a group of philanthropists in Switzerland that really want to fund climate activists and fund like very grassroots projects and fund them quickly. Right. So basically, like, really do this matching of like, we have needs, we have things that people want to do, we have an urgency, and we have funds, but it's like, how can we help them find each other in a very like smooth and quick way? So basically, they started using co-budget last year and gathered several different activist organizations. And from that, had a subgroup of people that became the deciders on co-budget, that basically were the ones making the decisions on which projects would get funded. So they were like the active members. And it was just really fascinating to see how within a few months, quite a lot of money was able to go directly to these projects in quite a smooth manner. But I think also like really being able to incorporate the need for coordination and conversation and sense-making alongside the actual funding process about what is important and what do we actually want to fund. So to me, especially when we just think about topics like climate and all the great work that's wanting to happen out there, it feels like there's a real inspiring opportunity to get more funds to these kind of projects. And I think another one that I want to mention, because this is one of our like sort of ancient long-term co-budget users, which Alana also knows, is the Evolutionary Leadership they've changed their name. So I'm trying to remember now. It used to be called the Evolutionary Leadership Institute. But in any case, what's really interesting there, I think, is that we often talk about how you need to really develop this capacity in a group and like build a muscle and a practice around the rhythm of doing the collaborative funding. And so I think here you can really see a great example where there's sort of like a membership network of people that are working in the future of organizing space. And people pay a membership fee, and part of that fee goes into their co-budget accounts. And then they use that to basically fund different people in the network, running workshops, offering sessions, doing capacity building, training, all these different things. And so that process, from what I've been able to see, at least over the years, is really running like clockwork. Like, they have their rhythm set up. They do these rounds on a regular basis, like many times a year. And I feel really inspired by that sort of consistency of doing it, because that's how you really ingrain a practice and build that understanding in a group that can really like grow and deepen and improve over time. So I'm actually quite curious to also interview them and understand like how over the years also that's evolved. Because I think often when I've been talking to newer groups, I think they often underestimate like how much you gain from doing this multiple times and really like tweaking the process and improving it. And the people also sort of observing the group dynamics that emerge. Because I guess one anecdote, because I think we've seen this in Spiral and in many groups, is that often at the beginning, people tend to fund shiny stuff, like the things that are like, ooh, let's get t-shirts for, you know, this event, or let's paint the living room orange, or, you know, something that's like sort of exciting and seems sort of easy and accessible. And I think many groups go through that process of realizing that they do that in the first iteration, and then like realize, oh, maybe actually there's other things that are more important though. And then they start sort of getting more into that like strategic thinking space. But I find that it's hard to come to that realization without going through that process. So it's just so good to do it again and again and really train it, because, you know, we've been trained for decades and like centuries now in certain other models. And so I think to try to change them, we need to also really just practice like going to the gym.
I love that. And is there like a sweet spot in terms of like size or scale that you've seen, or I guess it's different at different scales?
I mean, I think that actually many different scales are possible. Like, I myself was quite blown away with some of our new co-budget colleagues. They've been doing some really incredible collaborative budgeting practices for also like, yeah, almost 10 years now, with tools they built themselves, with these huge participatory festivals. One of them is called the Borderland. It's sort of like a Burning Man in Denmark. And they do this with thousands of people that basically allocate money to funding art at the festival. And like, it's at a scale that I myself had not imagined. And yeah, it's really, really impressive. And I think that like with all of these processes, you just need to design the process to account for the size. So it's really not one size fits all. But I think you need to make the necessary adjustments to actually also take into account, okay, what is going to play out? What are the dynamics? What are the numbers? And I think that actually tools like Open Collective can be quite helpful when you think about sort of large numbers and many transactions and many people that need to get reimbursed and things like that. So I think a lot is possible.
And it opens up a lot of complexity, I guess, for the organization. And Open Collective, I think, is one of those hidden, for me personally, it's been a real eye-opener to discover it and to think about how we can use it. We use Open Collective now for running all of the financial operations for the Better Work Together book project. Alana, I wonder if you could just connect the dots for us there between the difference between a normal organization and something that's, I guess, got that networked approach of using money and sharing money, and how Open Collective fits into that puzzle.
Yeah, well, Open Collective is adjacent, I would say, to CoBudget's problem space, but actually they don't overlap that much. Like, CoBudget is a tool for making decisions about what you're going to do with a pool of money. And Open Collective is for solving all the really hairy, painful problems around actually moving money around in the world and holding money. So it does things like, you know, plugs into payment processing systems, it solves problems like bank accounts, and it offers fiscal sponsorship, what we call fiscal hosting, which is a way for one entity to offer itself as an umbrella for many unincorporated projects. So for example, something like the Better Work Together book project, which isn't itself a company or doesn't want to incorporate a company itself, can be under the umbrella of Open Collective New Zealand, which is the case with Better Work Together, but we have lots and lots and lots of those umbrella organizations around the world. And it basically solves the problem of, you know, not needing to get a bank account and incorporate and hire an accountant and deal with legals and all this stuff, or think about taxes just because you want to do a collaborative project or a community group or a social movement or things that don't necessarily fit the frame of a company or a charity. So yeah, that's what it's for. And it does things like crowdfunding, actually processing all the payments for money coming in, you know, processing grants and bank transfers and tracking all the budgets and tracking all the data and exporting all the data that you might would need for your accountant and all this stuff. And it provides this way for fiscal host organizations, these umbrella organizations, to take on a lot of the bureaucracy and the compliance stuff and everything so that the groups can focus on their communities and on their mission. So that's kind of the space that Open Collective fills. What was the second part of your question?
I want to understand, like, so if I'm out there and I'm in a membership organization, or I want to start an organization or a group and we want to share money, it feels like all of the tools are around and available. So if I don't have an entity, I can use something like an Open Collective. I can set up a partnership with a fiscal host and they're going to manage all of that stuff, and then I can use a tool like CoBudget and everyone in my group can have a share of the money and we can decide how we want to spend it together, and then voila, we're there, right? At a tool level, obviously it's kind of like we've been swimming in that water for a while, so we've lost sight of the water. But why is that important? Like, why is it important that we can do these kind of things in the future? What's the function that you both see this being used for?
I think it's useful to kind of wind back and remind ourselves what the function is or was of the kind of older ways of doing things. Like, what is a corporation? Why do people form companies? And like the history of that is basically, it's a way for groups to come together and have an identity that can act in the world and be treated in the legal system and in the financial section, in the legal system and the financial system as an entity. Like this whole thing of like a corporation as a person, like that obviously has very negative connotations, but what that means is a corporation can sign contracts, a corporation can open a bank account, a corporation can have liability for a thing. And that's very important when you're dealing with money. Like, money instantly brings up all these questions of like, well, who owns it? Who pays taxes on it? Like, all of our big institutions and systems in the world expect you to take a certain form. And a lot of these forms were, you know, we came up with them 1 to 500 years ago based on very different technology and very different tool set that we had at the time around how fast communication can work, how fine-grained you can kind of track different things. Now we have computers, we have the internet, and we can basically just evolve. We can evolve to the next level. But a lot of times it feels, you can get stuck and it can feel very heavy to have to deal with those old systems. So you've got kind of the whole like crypto world trying to just like completely leapfrog into the new world and completely leave behind the legacy legal and financial system. That's not exactly practical in some ways. Like, in some ways it's great, and in other ways people like need to pay their rent in dollars, and you have to ask yourself things like, well, how does this interact with employment law, me getting paid from this thing, or how do I pay my taxes, all this kind of stuff. So Open Collective is a bridging function between the old legacy world and the new coming hyper-collaborative open paradigm. And it's like an API that plugs into both of those worlds and can translate between them. And the reason that's powerful is there's huge power in these highly collaborative, highly agile and transparent ways of working. And I think we can see that in a lot of examples in the world. And you can just feel it sometimes when it happens in social media, like amazing social coordination happening or networks emerging, like we've been talking about highly collaborative networks. And how can you not impede that power and that agility when that world tries to interact with things like, yeah, contracts and banks and invoices and all this kind of stuff. So Open Collective basically tries to create a bubble of space for them, for those kind of networks to be who they are, but still get things done.
Yeah, and maybe I would just add to that, that if we look at a lot of the innovation that's been happening around new ways of organizing, I'm thinking about like Teal, which obviously is a whole concept around self-organizing and self-management and others. I think we see a lot of development when it comes to the culture and the practices. But what we can often observe is when it comes to then actually making decisions about money, that somehow that's separate because of all of the things Alana was describing around the legal and the financial system creating certain requirements and needs. So I feel like it's almost like trying to play some catch up so that the cultural practices that we're experimenting with and starting to people are really living and implementing, that the financial decision making also fits with that and is not completely mismatched. And because I think if that part doesn't also join, then it's quite limited, the change that we're really making, because if the money flows in terms of, you know, how they're controlled and also where the money goes, if that still stays in the current status quo, we're really putting a lid on how much we can achieve with these open collaborative networks.
I think the other, like, money is a precious resource that we want to use efficiently. And another thing that's a precious resource that we need to use efficiently is people's energy and human capacities. And if you think about, well, what happens if you don't incorporate and then somebody has to open a bank account and receive, like, I just got a terribly distressing email the other week from someone who's like, during the pandemic, we started doing mutual aid in our neighborhood, and then people started donating, and we did a crowdfunding campaign, and people donated this money, and we spent all the money on food for people in the neighborhood. But now the IRS says I owe them $18,000 because I received those funds to my personal bank account. And these are the kinds of problems, like, you know, something like, okay, we do this thing as a group, but now we need a truck to do the thing that we want to do in the world. Like, who's going to own the truck? Whose insurance goes with the truck? Basically, you risk those situations where you kind of unfairly leave individuals holding the bag. And I think we've probably all seen that lots of times in lots of ways where there's a collaborative group, something needs to get done, and somebody says, oh, whatever, I'll just do it. I'll just put my, we'll put the subscription on my credit card or whatever. But these things add up. And a lot of times they don't end up in an $18,000 bill or something that big, but they do add up over time to, I think, degrading our collective capacity and safety. And this is why I'm so interested in things like, you know, livelihoods, stable livelihoods. How do we create stable livelihoods for people to full-time, you know, work on the solidarity movements and stuff like this? Because usually people are doing this in very patched together, marginal ways. And we have to make it so that people can do that in a stable way. I live in New Zealand, but a lot of my work is also in the US. And in the US context, like, people get health insurance through their jobs. And if you are not organized in as a thing that can plug into that system, what you end up with is people just not getting healthcare. And ultimately that means you've got like activists and the community builders who are doing the most important work, in my opinion, in the world, like not being well taken care of. And I think money is similar to that, in that like, it's a thing that's, it's a heuristic for measuring your collective capacity to look after people in some ways. I guess that sounds really bad. Like in our capitalist system, it is in some ways the heuristic. There are many things that money cannot represent, but it can represent some things. And I think the theory of change that I bring, or that the view of the world that makes sense to me, is we can solve those problems by collectivizing. We can solve those problems by coming together, pooling resources, creating structures that are bigger than I can do on my own, and then that we have more power together. That's like, I guess, the core organizing principle of a lot of the things that I do. And there are really powerful mechanisms in the world that we can access through collective power. So yeah, that really simple example, like, we've got a nonprofit set up in the US, we've got all these mutual aid and other groups under it. Collectively, we can plug in and, you know, get them health insurance and get people livelihoods. And, you know, insurance is such a boring topic. I'm really interested in things other people think are really boring, but like, the origin of insurance is collectives coming together and saying, like, we don't know which one of us is going to be really unlucky, so let's pool our risks together and pool some of our resources together. And then if any one of us gets in trouble, they'll be taken care of. And of course, that's now been co-opted by like horrible capitalist forces, but that's not so different than like at Inspiral, we work cooling resources and like somebody's laptop got stolen and they were, you know, not earning a ton of money and they were a developer who was earning their livelihood with this laptop and they were like really challenged by this moment. And then it's just like, oh, cool. Well, we'll just co-budget a bucket and buy you a new laptop. And it's like that, but multiplied thousands and millions of times in lots of different ways.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of articulating it. I think I hear two threads and I want to call back to one that Fran mentioned earlier with the Swiss philanthropists. But on one level, I can see there's an organic tipping point where a group gets complicated enough or useful or busy enough and they start having to organize money and then it goes into people's personal bank accounts. And then at some point, there's a tipping point where they have to become an organization or all of that sort of complexity has to get held somewhere. And what I heard in what you were saying with Open Collective is that that tipping point can shift and change, and actually there's new pipes that can hold some of that complexity and allow those groups to continue to just focus on doing the mutual aid work that they're doing or the community organizing that they're doing, rather than having to get bogged down and hiring an admin person to figure out how to keep their charity afloat. And then with the philanthropists, just this notion of capital allocation and knowing that there are billions of dollars that are trying to be spent on planet Earth right now to solve this challenge around climate action, for one, that we absolutely have to solve in this next coming generation or two. Well, actually, not in this generation. And we're missing some mechanisms in order to allocate that capital well. I think those two reasons alone to me are enough to articulate, like, why bother? Like, why to figure this out? The other thing that I'm curious to bounce off the both of you is I was waiting and I was going to see how long it would take before I had to bring it up. And then Alana, you dropped the C word in there, but it is 2022 and we have this crypto thing and we have this buzz that's happening. And I know for anyone who's working in sort of anything remotely collaborative, decentralized, et cetera, there's all of this hype around DAOs, tokens, everything's different now. Oh my God, we're going to change the world with this stuff. And obviously we're not there in the future yet. There's a bridging function to be had, but I'm personally really optimistic and I'm excited by some of the experimenting that's happening in the space with tokens, and tokens just being another different word for money with a different ambiguous legal thing to figure out. For the people out there working in DAOs and wanting to like actively figure this stuff out, are there any pointers, starting points, things that you would say to them?
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. And I guess I agree with you that it's really exciting, all of the like brain power and talent and experimentation that's going into the crypto space right now. And I'm definitely super excited about the speed of some of those experiments and what we can learn from that. And I think the main thing that just feels really important that I would say to someone working in this space is that the technological innovation is not going to address the human problems, right? The group dynamics that happen. And they might even be quite different than what we've experimented so far, because they might be group dynamics at other scales. And that is gonna, like, maybe right now, because the technology is often still so slow, and it's such a like ball and chain that people aren't even noticing how difficult the group dynamics part actually is. Although I think there's more and more awareness for that. But to me, that's the real big problem, or the challenging part that's really juicy, that like is actually much more difficult to resolve. So I think it's just important to give attention to that and to realize that even if we build this new great infrastructure, if we actually don't know how to use it as a group, and to like use it in a way that will actually help us achieve our objectives, we're just going to keep reproducing the same thing as we were doing before. And to me, then we're back where we started. We just have like a hard-coded infrastructure of the old patterns that we wanted to get rid of. So yeah, I think lots of opportunity, and also hoping that we can, I guess, bridge a little bit more with all of these practices that have been growing for, you know, decades and centuries and from many different groups, to actually infuse that and learn from each other.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with what Fran was saying. I think that the actual technical systems that are being built are designed to solve, I would say, 5% of the total problem space, and they are being treated in some ways as 95% or something like that, whereas the human group dynamics, decision-making, governance, strategy, communication, all human relationship side of it is, in my opinion, the hard problems, and in some ways the technical solutions focus on the part that's easy to solve with technology, which is not the whole question. That's not to say that it's not valuable. Like, I think I'm really, really happy all these experiments are going on. I don't know which ones are going to be successful. I do know that, like, 50 years from now, some really influential things going on in our society will harken back to the experiments that are going on now. And I think that's really exciting. But I think a lot of things in, like, cryptocurrency are red herrings. Like, if you break it down, I think the crypto part can be a red herring. Like, it's not necessary for most of these things to be cryptographic systems. A lot of times it seems like it's a little bit like a hammer looking for a nail, and unnecessarily makes it inaccessible. Like, for example, I was just looking into this cool project called Accord, which is basically smart contracts without the crypto part, because you don't need cryptographically created smart contracts in most circumstances. But the idea of, like, a programmable contract relationship is really cool. So I was, like, having a really geeky, excited conversation with a lawyer who also, like, that was the first time it clicked for him. Like, oh, smart contracts. It's not just a red herring, because actually we put the crypto part aside. It's actually interesting, and I could see this immediately being useful. And then I also think the currency part is like a really red herring as well. Like, money, the whole money conception in the crypto space, like, is only such a tiny percentage of what's interesting about decentralized cryptographic systems. I'm involved with some other projects which are really doing amazing things in the decentralized cryptographic system space that have nothing to do with currency and are all about, data sovereignty or different ways of, like, subjectively viewing social networking and really cool stuff. But the currency side is so dominant in the conversation. And I just think it's a little bit of a shame that all this crypto stuff came from, I guess, communities that were really dominated by, I don't know, bro culture or whatever you want to say. And it's changing. I'm really glad. But the, like, you know, solar punk feminist version of crypto, that whole world, it's growing, it's starting to rise, and that's going to bring in a lot more people, and it's going to, I think, change the conversation. And I'm really happy about that. Like, we need more diverse tools and conversations going on to really, I guess, realize the power of this whole space.
Yeah, nice. I think one noticing I've had, having jumped into a few Discord channels these days, is you really, really, really do not need tokens to enable a group to form a functioning decentralized organization where people are autonomous. That the tokens can absolutely just be a distraction from that.
I just wanted to add one thing about, I guess, tokens, which is sort of like a current dilemma that I'm having of, like, on the one side, seeing that tokenizing has some benefits in terms of microtransactions, being able to make lots of smaller pieces of something to create a more dynamic systems around governance. But at the same time, it feels really contrary to a lot of the things that we're experimenting with in Greater Than, which is more around actually coming closer to what value is and money. And for me, tokenization is sort of like abstracting money and creating sort of, you know, making it a game or helping you detach yourself from what that is, and getting very transactional. And in a way, some of the practices that I've seen lately that are really, really powerful are actually more leaning into the relational aspect of money and value exchange, which is something that, you know, is at a smaller scale that you would do that. But just, it feels like that there's something that you lose when you try to transactionalize and tokenize that actually is quite counter to the idea of building strong communities and relationships that support each other. So absolutely. Yeah, I haven't come to my conclusion on it, but I'm sort of like, yeah.
Totally, Fran. I'm totally on your wavelength. And I really feel that the power of collaborative networks in many ways comes from the non-transactional aspects. It comes from the indirect and relational value. That's what creates the possibility for that feeling of you're getting back more than you're putting in, or it's more than the sum of its parts. If it's all broken down into just strictly transactional relations, it's going to miss the real power of the thing. You know, if you think about, you know, what were like pre-currency economies like, and how much it was in many ways relational, and, you know, what is the purpose of a gift? You know, it's to create the sense of like, oh, we'll meet again, and we're going to exchange again, and I will give you a little bit more than you gave me, so that we have this relationship that continues and goes back and forth. And I guess for me, a big word that needs to be in the conversation is trust. And a lot of people getting excited about zero trust systems, and I'm just like, no, I don't know what was with that, but that's not the thing. Like, the everything, all of my experience of many years in many groups and in many collaborations and cooperatives and collectives, is just, it's all about trust enhancing systems and trust enhancing technology, trust enhancing tool, trust enhancing economies. Like, if we can put this technology to work for that, then we'll really have something.
Yeah, that's nice. I like the idea of computers being able to talk to each other without trusting each other and doing things together. That's great. But it doesn't really work that well for humans. And I think that's where the whole crypto space is starting to edge into now, which is like, oh, actually, we absolutely need trust. And a DAO is glued together by trust, which is a total 180. You both mentioned sort of leaning into the future here, and I would love to just get a sense. We've scratched the surface. When you talk about money, you scratch the surface of lots and lots of different things. So, you know, power, governance, trust, and there's no way that we can cover all of those things in a short podcast episode. So maybe there'll have to be round two or three for us on that. But when you think about the future and like some of the potential that's emerging, and, you know, some of the experiences that you've had and seen in groups, do you have a vision of hope or optimism for where this could go if it continues to grow in momentum, this movement of people getting better at spending money in groups together?
Yeah, it's creating the post-capitalist reality that we're trying to get to, right? I mean, it's not, I think that we must create alternative spaces where people have deep and real experience of the power of collectivism and the power of trust and the power of collaboration, because we have to hold that up next to the current mainstream extractive capitalist society that so many people are trapped in. But if we're going to be like, I often think of my work as basically like throwing parachutes to people in that paradigm so that they can jump out over into this, I don't know what this paradigm over here is called that we're building, whatever we want to call it, a collective, cooperative, different way of being together. So that's the point in some ways for me, is the alternatives. And we have to solve all the same problems, but in a different way. Things like, well, how do we allocate resources? How do we make decisions? How do we secure people's livelihoods? How do we form into organizations that have purposes or that can have identities and all this kind of stuff? I think it's all very practical. I guess I see that through the lens because I really enjoy the super practical operational side of it, obviously. But on a conceptual level, yeah, that's what it's all about to me, is showing that this other world it's real. It's not a fantasy. It's not a dream. It's not a far off utopia. It's real right now. There are many people living in it, in this other way of being that could be globally a way that would be not killing the planet and not, you know, killing each other and wars and all these things. I guess that does sound like super naive and idealistic. Yes, it does. But it's more like I can see the glimmers or the previews of like, well, what would it feel like to actually live in that world? What would it feel like if society was like that? And it happens in these moments where I feel like, okay, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to throw my dollars or my trust or, you know, my livelihood in with these people, and we're going to collectivize together and figure it out.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Alana. And I think in a way, to me, the groups spending money together, it's sort of like maybe a bridge to that future, because who knows, maybe in the future that we would like to see, we don't actually need money, or it works totally differently. Who knows, right? But in a way, like, to get there, to do the parachuting or whatever it is we're calling of that transition, I really think that it's so essential for us to have more trust in groups that have very different nature, that are more self-organized, to spend significant amounts of money and actually make those big moves that we need to address all of the problems that we're seeing. So I feel quite excited by the idea of like fundamentally like shifting and diversifying who's making these decisions about money, and like really diversifying a lot, because it just seems like today there's way too few voices represented in those decisions. And I don't really see how we're going to make the big changes we need without that. So yeah, changing how money flows basically in society, and maybe then getting rid of it in the future. Who knows? I don't know.
It makes me think about where Fran and I actually first met, which was at this crazy thing called POC 21 many years ago now. But it was basically like this thing in France where we're trying to build a temporary alternative society as like a alt space as COP 21 was going on. So let's do like actually building, you know, eco-technologies and living together in a village that we're making ourselves and stuff like that. It was quite cool for me because I, of course, care about climate change, but it was never like the center of my own focus of my work. And then being there, I was really challenged to be like, okay, but this is like the big problem of our times. Like, how do I connect the theory of change of the things that I'm working on to that problem space? And yeah, thinking it all through. And what I actually ended up coming to was, you know, whether we are heading for like climate apocalypse and social breakdown, or whether we are going to successfully change course and leapfrog that into post-capitalist collective utopia, either way, we're going to have to sit in circles and be really good at sitting in circles and figuring out what to do together and figuring out how to work together. And for me, these tools around money and these super tangible collaborative ways of, this is similar to like co-ops, you know, really co-owning a thing together or really controlling a pool of money together, is some of the most powerful practice that I have found to learn that skill set.
Yeah, nice. I like it. I like it a lot. I would love to keep this conversation going, but we are going to have to wind it up. And I am going to call you back for a part two or a part three as this Better Work Together podcast experiment continues. Before we do that, just to close us out, you've both been deep in this space for over a decade now, and I know there are a lot of people who are interested in getting started or who are sick and tired enough of other ways of working and organizing and looking for new solutions. And so if you think back over that period of time, are there any like really, really useful resources or books or pieces of media or anything that you would shout out that really helped form your thinking along the journey, aside from the book that we wrote together, of course?
Absolutely. Yeah, my picks would all be kind of utopian sci-fi books, because it is about that, you know, imagining into other realities is for me the inspiration for doing this work. It's like what kind of keeps me going is really believing, and that comes from like being a kid who grew up watching Star Trek, basically. Like, that's the dream. The Star Trek reality is the dream for me. But books like The Dispossessed, and I'd recently read one called Another Now, which is about economic transition into alternate future reality. I was thinking in this conversation earlier about a book, Walk Away, which has some really amazing scenes in it of like kind of personified, like when I was explaining the thing about like how, you know, DAOs aren't capturing the hard part of the problem. I just know some people listening are going to be like, what about a programmatic reputation systems? Anyway, there's like a guy who's that persona in this story, and like what happens with him is like, yes, I've seen that so many times. I wish there was more utopian sci-fi being written. I feel like our society is so enamored with the dystopian dark stories. And we actually, even like the Star Trek that they're making now is dystopian and dark. And it's like, no, this is not the thing. But utopian sci-fi, I think, for me.
Yeah, I guess I would probably, just to sort of complement that, I think often people wonder, like, what can I do as an individual to get started with this? Because, you know, it's hard to practice something as a group if you don't have a group yet, or maybe the group isn't ready and you want to sort of get into this. So I think one thing that has really had a big impact on me and also my work in Greater Than is Money Work, is what it's called. There's a thinker called Peter Koenig, who developed it. And there's a lot of really interesting practices and courses around basically exploring your personal relationship to money and uncovering your unconscious habits around it. And I really find it an extremely powerful experience or process to go through, and as really quite a key element to then changing as in groups how we look at money, because those stories are so strong of what money is to us. And so I think it's something that like has so much value for each of us as an individual to start doing. And there's actually a really great game called the Money Game that is a really interesting experience to start doing that with. And maybe I can send you over the link to learn more about that in the show notes. I think it's really a powerful thing to start working on, and that helps start moving in the right direction.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I'll scoop up all the links and attach them in the show notes. So just as we wind up, I know you're both busy and doing amazing work at the moment. If folks want to find out a little bit more about what you do, could you give them a shout out about where to go? And if there's any final words that you want to say, now's a good time to share them.
Yeah, people can definitely check out Open Collective if that's of interest to you. If you are a group who needs a structure to work through and doesn't want to be a company, or if you are an entity who wants to be an umbrella for such groups, it's a really great system. Opencollective.com, check it out. And it's weird, but I'm actually working mainly on one project these days. So it kind of all relates to that.
Yeah, I think if you follow me on LinkedIn, that's sort of where I share a lot about what I'm up to in terms of the different types of projects. And other than that, just going to greaterthan.works, because that's where we have also like different courses and events and a lot of sort of things that I'm doing right now. That's probably the best place to get the overview. And apart from that, just really grateful for you kicking off this conversation, Ants, because I really... love talking to both of you and think that there's so much interesting to unpack, and also glad that Better Work Together is back.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Super, super stoked to have you both. Thanks for saying yes. That brings us to the close of the first episode of this experiment.
Thank you, Ants. Really appreciate you.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Brian. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.